desirable. When you put the right kind of a balun, it acts like a one-to-one transformer, where, let me drop, it acts like an ideal isolation transformer where you've got a primary winding that your coax cable is feeding, you've got a secondary winding, which is magnetically coupled to the primary winding, but the secondary winding is thoroughly floating in space. And now, whether you feed a symmetric dipole in the center, or you feed an off-center fed dipole, if your balun has enough capability, it acts like that one-to-one transformer. It doesn't care about whether or not the load is balanced, unbalanced, or whatever. And in theory, if the balun is ideal, it gives you a perfect shield characteristic where essentially no RF energy will flow down the outside of the coax cable when it's being fed with an ideal balun. But there's a couple of catches. Let me drop. In order for that balun to do that, you must be operating it at the power level it's rated for, the frequency region it's rated for, the Viswa level it's rated for. I can take an ideal balun that's made for 80 meters, and it's made for a kilowatt at 80 meters, and the manufacturer didn't mention anything about 160, and you lose it at a much lower frequency, 160. You may find out the balun is fairly poor in its isolation characteristics. You take that same balun that's rated for a kilowatt at 80 meters, and you use it at a kilowatt at 80 meters into an antenna that's a 4-to-1 standing wave ratio. You may saturate the iron that's in that balun, and it may act like a poor balun again. So in order for you to get the full performance out of the balun, three things has to happen. Number one, the manufacturer has to be telling the truth. Number two, you must be using it at the frequency range he says it's designed for. Number three, you must be using it at the power level and Viswa level that he says it's designed for. So he's got to be telling the truth. You've got to be using it on the right frequency. You've got to be using it at the right power level or below. And you've got to be using it at the right standing wave ratio or below. You violate any one of those three characteristics, you may have a really terrible balun on your hands. And what's the solution? Buy a bigger balun. Buy one that's rated for higher power than you're using it for. Add more ferrite toroids to it. If you actually take apart many of these one-to-one balans, what you'll find is a bunch of, let me drop, you'll find it's got a whole bunch of donut toroids stacked on the outside of the coax cable, and all of that is inside of a piece of polyvinyl chloride or PVC tubing with nice weather sealing on the end and mechanical supports and eyes coming out of the sides and whatever. But inside, there's really only, in many cases, on some of these balans, like the W2AU type balun, there is a bunch of these toroid ferrite donuts stacked on the outside of the coax cable. Your first question is going to be, what in the world are they doing? They are acting as an RF choke. If you can force the outside of the coax cable to have a high enough choking inductance between the input end and the output end of that balun, then it will, by definition, not allow coax RF energy to flow down the outside of the coax. It is an RF check choke on the outside, but it has no effect on the RF energy flowing down the inside of the coax cable. But that RF choking action of those toroids has a limit. You go low enough in frequency, they will saturate. You go high enough in power, they will saturate. You go high enough in standing wave ratio, they will saturate. You saturate those toroids, you're not a balun anymore. You're almost half as bad as if you connected the coax cable to the dipole itself. You've now heard 10% of what you would like to know about balans from my point of view. Guarantee Mel's got a whole bunch of other things to tell us about balans. Let's hear his point of view. K2KEY, what have you been telling these guys in all of these thousand word responses you've been giving them, Mel? I'm kidding you a little bit. K2KEY, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Net, tonight at 8 o'clock, this is the W2VL repeater.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Well, you sort of alluded to a number of the things I was going to discuss. But basically, I'll answer the questions here, and then I'll get into a bit more in depth, because you did hit upon a number of factors. There are a number of balams that are available. You mentioned Amadon. You didn't mention Amadon Associates. They provide, you can buy balam kits from them based on a number of the designs of W2FMI, Jerry, who just passed away in the last couple of weeks. Sorry to see old Jerry go, and a great guy. And so he did a lot of work, and he did come up with a number of balams, such as 4-to-1s, 6-to-1s, 9-to-1, some in between that you can come up with, like 6.25-to-1, and you say, why and where? All right, somebody, first day it came up today, somebody asked me, they got to replace a balam that blew up, it cracked the core, and it was for matching a 450-ohm ladder line. And the obvious answer is, why should I use, for a 450-ohm ladder line, why shouldn't I use a 9-to-1 balam? And at first it sounds reasonable. First I'll say to you one thing for sure. Just because you've got 450-ohm line does not mean that you've got 450 ohms at the other end of the wire. If unless that antenna is 450 ohms, you will not have 450 ohms there. So you can have any kind of resistance up there until up to the ends, up to even a couple thousand ohms. Let it drop. Okay, so anyhow, so this is the reason that say, well, 4-to-1 balam should do the job, and, well, to pursue it a little further with it, if we had, for instance, these wide resistances, and we were to put the cable, say, right directly to the antenna, and let's say we have resistances that run up in a couple thousand, let's say 2,000 ohms, we have 50 to 2,000 ohms between our cable, and if we coiled it, we'd have a 1-to-1 balam, as Dick just said. So what would we have? We'd have a 50, we'd have 50 ohm, we'd have a 1-to-40 a match. Quite ridiculous, would it be? Imagine what the SWR would be. Now, if we went ahead and we take, for instance, our 4-to-1 balam, put it in there, the impedance would be transformed. Well, the 50 ohms would be actually transformed to 12.5, and our 2,000 would be 4 into 2,000, would be 500 ohms. So we now have a conversion from 4-to-1 to 10-to-1. Sounds a little better, of course. So, on and on now, if we were, let me let it drop. Now, if we went ahead using that thinking and used this 9-to-1 balam that this person called me and asked me, why don't I use the 9-to-1? Well, let's see. With the 9-to-1 balam in the same situation, the 50 ohms would now drop to about 5.5 ohms or so. The 2,000 ohms would drop somewhere to about 200 and plus 225 ohms, 222 ohms. So now we would have a 4-to-4, and the 9-to-1 balam would be possibly working, but as well, but the but is it's easier, and the losses to make a 4-to-1 is much easier, because the lower the balam ratio, basically, I'm just going to answer this question and go on. The lower the balam ratio and the wider the balam bandwidth, it can be done for the same in the same construction by using the 4-to-1, basically, which I will get into a little further. But take it from me, the 4-to-1 will suffice. Go ahead, Dick.
Okay, Mel is now getting us into the next level of what balams can do. One, I tried to emphasize in the case of a 1-to-1 kind of balun where the input impedance is 50 ohms and the output impedance is 50 ohms, for instance, why would you use it? Because you want this isolation characteristic. You want it to act like an ideal isolation transformer where current does not flow down the outside of the coax cable. Some people call that kind of a balun a current balun as opposed to a voltage balun. We haven't gotten heavily into that yet. Also, when it comes to what impedance is your dipole as a function of its length and the diameter of the wire you made it out of. Once you choose the wire diameter and the length of the wire, you can choose by a curve. You can find out exactly what impedance you're going to get. Those curves are the so-called Brown and Woodward curves. You can find it in Chapter 4 of most of the issues of Antenna Engineering Handbook. Also, when it comes to baluning devices, there's something like 20 different kinds of baluns just in basic schematic diagram, even before you start getting into high impedance, low impedance, high in frequency, low frequency, whatever. And there's a classic article on that subject that was in the Microwave Theory and Techniques Journal of the IEEE, roughly 1968, and it's an article by Ruthroff, R-U-T-H-R-O-F-F. Ruthroff, and the name of his article is Some Baluning Devices. He covered the waterfront with about 20 different kinds of balun, but that's the name of the article. And all the basic baluning types are there. They're also in the fourth edition of the Antenna Engineering Handbook. There's a whole chapter on baluns. Very complicated subject. Now, let me drop for a second. There's a zillion kinds of baluns. Many of them have proper names connected to them. Marchand, for instance. Marchand, M-A-S-H-A-N-T or A-U-N-T, I think is Marchand balun, is a very popular kind of balun that's used for feeding a cavity-backed spiral antenna. And that happens to be a current mode one-to-one balun with a very complicated structure. It's a microwave type of balun. By the way, those curves that I've been telling you about, the Brown and Woodward curves, if you don't want to go to your technical library and look up Antenna Engineering Handbook, and if you had to buy the book, it's $130. But those curves, you can get them free of charge by going to the website where Mel and Dick are covered every week. You go to a website called www.amateurradio.tangovictor. Amateurradio.tangovictor. You go to that website, and every one of these tech nets for the last 4 or 5 years are thoroughly recorded and documented. You can go there, and you can look up every one of these past tech nets, make a tape recording of them, play them in your car while you're driving to work or on the train or whatever. However, on that website, you will see a separate article that you can go to called The Decibel Discussions by K2KEY, The Smith Chart Discussions by K2KEY, Yagi Technical Information by K2RIW. You go to the Yagi Technical Information, and there you'll find out a lot of information about balance, although that wasn't the intent of the article. It was talking about impedance matching, ideal impedance matching of a Yagi. And you'll also find the Brown and Woodward curves, free of charge, right at that website. Now, let me drop again. The original meaning of the word balance, it is a contracted word from balanced to unbalanced. It's a contracted word of balanced and unbalanced. If you wanted to spell it out, it is Baker Alpha Lima Uniform November, B-A-L-U-N. Occasionally it is spelled B-A-L-U-U-N, but it's B-A-L-U-N for November. A number of people have heard people pronounce it over the air, and they think they're hearing Baker Alpha Lima Uniform Mike. That last letter is November. So if you want to properly pronounce it, it's B-A-L-U-N for November. But now, once you recognize the fact that the balun in the ideal world for a current balun gives you the effect of a one-to-one transformer, once you accept the fact that it has transformer-like isolation characteristics, there's nothing magic about making it one-to-one. You can make a balun 1.5 to 1, 2 to 1, 4 to 1, 3 to 1, 9 to 1, and so on. And as Mel is now telling you, let me drop. just because you're using 450 ohm cable, and just because you're using 50 ohm cable, does not in any way guarantee that the input impedance of that cable is going to be 450 or 90 respectively, or 50 ohms. If you are terminating your transmission line on the far end with a loading device, which in your case is usually the antenna, and if that antenna has exactly the right impedance as a pure resistance, if you're using 450 ohm ladder line, and if your antenna happens to be a 450 ohm resistor with no reactive component left over, then yes, in that condition, the input cable will look like 450 ohms. You terminate that 450 ohm ladder line with any other impedance than 450 ohms of resistance, and what you're going to see on the input end is something that you're going to study with a Smith chart, and in general, it's going to be very different than you expect. So, like Mel was saying, to guarantee you have exactly a 9-to-1 balance, so that 4 times 9 is, wait a minute now, 5 times 9 is 40, yeah, a 9-to-1 balance would give you an exact impedance match between 50 ohms and 450. Well, it doesn't have to be exactly 9-to-1 impedance ratio, because very rarely is your 450 ohm cable going to be seeing exactly a 450 ohm resistive antenna. And as you make that length of line anything else, and if that impedance is anything but its characteristic impedance of the transmission line, what you're going to see is a whole lot of different impedances depending on the length of the line and the frequency you're operating at. Because as you QSY, you're changing the number of wavelengths of your transmission line, and therefore you're rotating yourself around that circle you've drawn on the Smith chart when you know how to do it correctly, and each one of those dots on that circle represents the impedance you're going to get at that particular frequency you calculate. So I didn't say this is simple. Mel and I are not saying it's simple. The first time you hear all this jazz, it's going to snow you. And if you feel snowed, you're in good company. You're going to have to hear all this jazz 2 or 3 times before it starts making sense, unless you've got quite a bit of experience in the area. I bet you the first time, a few times you heard this jazz, as I did, Mel, you probably said to yourself, what in the world is going on? K2KEY. K2RIW.
No doubt, heard it as a teenager, some of this stuff I heard, you know, from people that so-called had experience, and they came up with some of real buttes, and I shook my head and said, something don't sound right. I better learn from the bottom up, and like you say, it takes a lifetime, and even now I'm still learning. All right, let me answer one more question on this, and then we'll start maybe at the beginning, because we sort of been going circling the wagon there, and the trouble is in the middle, not around the periphery, because I see where the misunderstandings are. Another question that came, this guy also said to me, hey, he gives me his antenna. I'm feeding my 80-meter dipole that's around 35 feet up with 600-ohm open wire. Why shouldn't I use a 12-to-1 balance? Gee, why did you tell me to use a 4-to-1? And here we go again. Well, if you have an antenna that's approximately around 35 feet or so above ground, so-called ground, on 80 meters, the actual resistance depends on the height above ground in wavelength. And I'll give you another example of that in one moment. So let's say if this dipole is somewhere maybe around, could be around 40 ohms, when you, and at the transmitter end, your 600 ohm wire, the line, which would be around halfway long, say around 120 feet on 80 meters, you're going to see about 40 ohms. So if it repeats itself, if you look at the line and it repeats itself every half wave, by the time you get a quarter wave long, you can see resistances in the thousands, over 8,000 ohms, in fact. So what happens is, rather than try to find this 12-to-1 balun, unless that antenna is 600 ohms from the other end, in other words, you're coming out, you're converting 600 ohms, you're not going to, just as Dick says, you're not going to see 600 ohms at the other end of the wire. Let me let it drop. Let me see if I can clarify that a little better. Let's say you have a dipole, a folded dipole. A folded dipole will exhibit somewhere around 300 ohms at approximately 0.225 wavelengths, if I'm not mistaken, above ground. As you drop it now, let's say you get down to about point 0.17 wavelength, it drops to 200 ohms, the folded dipole. If you get down to like 0.35 wavelength, if I'm not mistaken, I think it drops to around 400 ohms. So that's why if you look at this point, a 4-to-1 Balaam usually does the job. You want to critique that, Dick Goer?
KC2WBH, question.
KC2WBH, you're on the list. We're going to get to you in a second. Part of what Mel is telling you is that every one of these wire-like dipole antennas that you set up on HF frequencies really are nowhere near free space. The number of wavelengths of altitude you're able to set that antenna at, let me drop, in many cases is rarely one wavelength. You're at a fraction of wavelength of altitude. That RF energy, when it sees the dirt in your backyard, you may think it's got grass and beautiful lawn on top and great fertilizer underneath, and beyond that it's got some clay and whatever. That's what your eye sees, that's what your shovel sees when you dig it up. To an RF wave, that backyard of yours is 80% of the way of being a perfect metallic mirror. Therefore, you've got a real dipole above ground, there's a mirror image of that dipole below ground, and because a horizontally polarized wave hitting a conducting surface experiences a 180 degree phase reversal, that mirror image of the dipole below ground is 180 degrees out of phase. The bottom line is that you'll see drastically different impedances of that dipole depending on what altitude in wavelength it is above the earth in your backyard. If you go to the ARL antenna book, there is a set of curves in there to show you what impedance you get for a half-wave dipole versus wavelengths above the ground. So this is predictable. So your dipole in free space, if you're doing it 200 yards behind the space shuttle in orbit, yes, your dipole half-wavelength long would be a 70-ohm antenna. In your backyard, very rarely is that going to be a 70-ohm antenna at the altitude that you're able to mount it at. But the ARL handbook will tell you what impedance you're going to get. The ARL antenna handbook. The antenna book. You go to the right chapter, that curve is there. And there's a couple of different curves. There's different ways that that can be displayed. And there's modeling programs that allow you to go the next step if you want real accuracy where, let me drop. You tell the program what kind of dirt you've got and how many feet you've got and whether or not the antenna is slanted. Is there a house nearby? There's a whole bunch of variables involved. The next thing Mel was getting at is that transmission lines have got a peculiar characteristic. If the transmission line is a even number of quarter wavelengths long, it is, in the ideal world, an impedance repeater. You take a 50-ohm piece of coax, make it an even number of wavelengths long. That means half wave, full wave, one and a half wave, an even number of quarter waves long. Two quarter waves, four quarter waves, six quarter waves. And you put on your 50-ohm coax cable, you put a 91.5-ohm resistor at the far end. If your coax cable is low enough in loss, you will measure 91.5 ohms on the input end. That's the magic of multiples of half wave, or an even number of quarter waves. An odd number of quarter waves is an impedance inverter. Put 100 ohms on the far end of a 50-ohm cable, that is a quarter wavelength long, or an odd number of quarter wavelengths long, the 100-ohm resistor on the far end will look like a 25-ohm resistor on the input end. You're going to say, what in the world's going on here? the 100 ohms is twice as high as the impedance of the cable, which is 50. That means there's going to be a 2-to-1 ratio. However, because it is an impedance inverter, because it's a quarter wavelength long, the input end is going to be, again, a 2-to-1 ratio away from 50, and that's 25. Ain't that crazy? You put 100 ohms on the far end of a cable that's a quarter wavelength long, and it's 50 ohm cable, and you're going to see 25 ohms on the input end. Go to twice the frequency, where now the cable is, instead of a quarter wavelength long, it's a half wavelength long. The 100 ohm resistor on the far end will be a 100 ohm resistor on the input end. So, as you can see, you may be going to somebody's design, let me drop, somebody's design where he told you it's a 300 ohm antenna, or he told you it's a 73 ohm antenna, and he's talking about the ideal world in free space. The real impedance you get in your backyard, at your altitude, alongside of your garage, 15 feet away from the metal gutters, the rain gutters of your particular house, you're going to get some other impedance on that cable. And if you've got a ballon that's got enough hair on its chest, a ballon that's got enough stealth in the way it was constructed, there's nothing wrong with having a mismatched ballon. In the case of the simple one-to-one ballons I talked about earlier that are made with just those ferrite toroids, you got to worry about saturating them. There's a whole other lot of ways of manufacturing ballons that don't saturate as well. And if you've got one that's rated for a kilowatt and you're using it 100 watts, the fact that your antenna presents a 4-to-1 standing wave ratio to the ballon, and therefore your 50 ohm cable going to that ballon sees something that's 4-to-1, it might be seeing 200 ohms, it might be seeing a 12.5 ohms. And then that coax cable, which is feeding the ballon, is being fed by an antenna tuner, and the antenna tuner has enough range to it. As terrible as that sounds, that whole system I just described, with mismatches all over the place, could easily have 96% transmission line efficiency. So, high standing wave ratio, with the right kind of an antenna tuner, with a ballon that's rated correctly high enough in power for the way you're using it, doesn't have to be a perfect impedance match. There's a lot more going on. I'll admit the first time you hear all this jazz, you're going to say, what in the world? I don't understand it. If you said those words, you're in good company. You're going to have to hear all of this from Mel and Dick and other guys, hopefully that are well-informed. We think we're well-informed. Mel and I have been around doing this kind of jazz for 40 years. We've got a lot of experience. We think we know some of the answers, not all of them. But you're going to have to hear all this jazz from the right person a number of times before it makes some sense. I know that KC2WBH had a question. Start off with your name, sir, and give us your question. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
KC2WBH, first name is Jay. How you doing, Dick? Good evening. I've been listening for a few weeks, and I heard you touch on a situation that might be something that of interest to me. I'm going to be setting up my station on top of the roof of the garage, where I will mount my HF antenna and my dual band UHF VHF antenna, probably with about 10 feet in between. For me to run my station in the basement of my house, I need to go underground through conduit. I am going to run electric alongside in a separate conduit as my coaxial cables. I wanted to know, do you think that would possess a problem with me, with TVI, and with bleed-over transmission? KC2WBH, Jay, listening.
If you obey the rules correctly, no. Your buried coax cable alongside of other conduits and other things of the house should be thoroughly isolated from each other, if and only if your coax cable is well grounded on both ends, well shielded. In other words, if the connectors on both ends are properly installed so that the cable itself is shielded, and you're using the right kind of a balloning device on the antenna end of your cable so that you don't have RF energy flowing down the outside. In the ideal world, coax cable, particularly the kinds of coax cable that are made for direct burial, like hardline, many of the hard lines with the outer polyvinyl jacket, like the kinds that are used for cable television service, the 3/4 inch and 7/8 inch, let me drop. They're made for direct burial in the ground for 20 years with no problem. And in the ideal world, coax cable, all of the RF energy is on the inside of the cable and none of it's on the outside. But as you've been hearing us discuss, if you don't have the right kind of a balancing device in the way you connect it to your particular antenna, you could end up with RF energy flowing down the outside of the cable. When you do have energy flowing on the outside of the cable, and that cable lies parallel to anything else, the 110-volt cable for your house, the telephone line, whatever, if it lies parallel to it, it's going to couple RF energy over to it, and that could give you some grief. Doesn't happen often, but know about it. Now, what's the defense for that? Make sure there's no RF current flowing down the outside of the cable. There's ways to test for that. You can put a loop of wire around the outside of your cable. You can put that into the right kind of sensing equipment, like a spectrum analyzer, like an RF sniffer, like a receiver, with the right kind of a attenuator in the receiver, and you can measure whether or not there's any current flowing down the outside of your cable. Current flowing down the outside of your cable, RF current, will create a local magnetic field, and the loop of wire you put around the cable will sense the RF energy into that magnetic field, and you'll be able to measure it. And there's ways you can calibrate that that are almost traceable to the Bureau of Standards. So when in doubt, you can make a measurement. And if you do find there's RF current flowing down the outside of your coax cable, there's ways of correcting it. Putting that into a separate piece of conduit is the brute force approach. Let me drop. But there you're attacking the symptom, not the cause. The cause is RF unbalance when it comes to the loaded end of the transmission line. You use the transmission line correctly. It is a perfectly shielded structure for the first 90 decibels, and I'm not kidding. 90 decibels is a 1 billion to 1 ratio. In theory, if 1 billion watts is flowing down the inside of your cable, and you're using it correctly, the power on the outside of the cable will be less than 1 watt. That's if you're really using it correctly. So the technology is there for you to make this a trouble-free situation. There's a zillion ways you can make it a troublesome situation, and I've given you a little hint about some of those. Over to you, Jay. KC2 WBH. K2RIW on the TechNet.
Thank you, Dick. I do believe you satisfied my question. I hope I will not receive a bill in the mail. But like I said, first time this is that I've transmitted on the net, and I got some good information, and I'd be sure to pass it on to my friends if they ever have any questions. KT2WBH, thank you very much. I'll be standing by listening.
Interesting.
Wesley recognized. Mel, sounds like we have another satisfied customer. He lives in Islip, so we're going to have to send him a bill. That was a joke. Not to worry. I wonder if you run into situations like this, Wesley. N2XJN, K2RIW.
Well, actually, what I wanted to do is, instead of, I can compliment you, Dick, and you both guys are really incredible. The point is very well taken. I have no further comment. Actually, I'm thinking, I'm always thinking about any questioning, anything that I could add into it. I believe it's just very well explained. But I have another change of the subject just because I was listening to the space report. And I wanted to say something in this matter. I believe it's a pretty interesting subject. The project that is called Constellation, let me jump for a moment. The project that is called Constellation, and this project is about colonization of the moon. All of a sudden, so many years after a man visited moon, and there was a conspiracy theory about it, whatever, Now they decided to come back. They dropped it for so long, over 4 years, and they want to do it again. And the next spacecraft is going to be called Orion. And the reason for it is one simple element that was missing before. They found the water on the Mars, large deposits of the water. And I would like to ask you whether you got across some information in this matter, and to Israel.
Okay, you got a darn good subject there, Wesley, and I'm not going to go too deeply into it tonight, because we have promised a bunch of people we're going to go fairly deeply into balance, and so far we've only scratched the surface on balance. But when it comes to return to the moon with the new spacecraft, which is called Project Orion, O-R-I-O-N, most people pronounce it Orion, but not necessarily, I am troubled by the belief that we're going to return to the moon very soon. When we were at the moon in June of 1969, it was in July of 1969, the real driving force there was the competition between the Soviet Union and the United States. That was the real driving force. And who had the best rockets, who had the best intercontinental ballistic missiles, who had the best spacecraft, who had the best killer satellites, who had the best synchronous orbit satellites. There was a huge competition going on. And that caused us to spend... Let me drop... That caused us to spend 10 years and $33 billion to send five missions to the moon. That's the Apollo 11, 12, 14, 15, 16. I think it's five missions to the moon. And 17 was the last one. There was supposed to be an 18 and 19, and they got canceled. After we accomplished the original goal, the reasons for going back to the moon and the cost involved and whether or not Congress will support it is a real question in my mind. I will be amazed if we go back to the moon in anything less than 10 or 15 years. And even if we do it then, I'll be mildly amazed. Yes, if we find water on the moon, and we have found some evidence of water in those craters at the South Pole, is that enough water to justify the mission? Is there life on the moon? Very unlikely. Does the moon have valuable materials? If the moon was made out of gold, platinum, and silver, the resources required to go there and get it and bring it back are so expensive that you would not make a profit if the moon contained the most valuable substance you and I can think of. Let me drop. So, economically, you can't support it. Research-wise, with manned missions, it's very difficult to support a return to the lunar surface. The unmanned missions are getting so good at being lower in cost, higher in probability of success, not putting life at risk, and operating for years on end. You send a man to the moon, you've got to send a tremendous amount of consumables to keep him alive. Very difficult, very expensive. So, colonization of the moon makes great science fiction. My personal belief is we're not going to see it for at least 15 or 20 years. That's my guess. I could be wrong. But to support it, when we got so darn many economic problems on planet Earth to solve, and you get so little economic benefit, scientific benefit, in sending a man to the moon, I'm having trouble believing we're going to do that. Are we going to send unmanned spacecraft? Lots of them. Are we going to send manned spacecraft? I'm becoming very skeptical. But what you're hearing is a strongly felt opinion. I might be wrong. I don't know who the competition is going to be to drive us again. Let me send it back to you, Eric. I mean, Wesley, for a quick one on that one. Then we got to get back to balance. N2XJN, K2LIW.
November 2X3, Julia, November. Atlantic is being called Constellation, and Orion is just the next spacecraft. And one of the things that they're planning to, I believe you're wrong. And of course, I'm not sure about it, but I believe within 5-6 years, you're going to see increased activity, not only from the United States, but from Chinese and Japanese. The thing is that although the politics says it is not good to deal with the Chinese in this matter, Chinese made so much progress and they have resources much cheaper than the others. There is a direct competition between Japanese and Chinese. You can find it in the internet about that area. Let me drop. That missing link that I said about finding water on the moon was actually a missing link that will actually very highly decrease the cost of men being on the moon. They are able to make the concrete from the natural resources of the moon just by having the water. So building the structure will be much less expensive than bringing the structure. Association the structure that is built on the moon with the existing one will be actually a tremendous help just because of the water. Let me drop. Typically what they plan to do is one of the two projects is bring the modules, looks like cylinders. Like the cylinders, you connect the cylinders all together. You can have any kind of shape you want to. And that actually will allow people to be with the crew of four up to 180 days on the surface of the moon. Another thing is that the speculation about how expensive is built the space shuttle, space base that is 220 miles right now from the surface of the Earth versus the one that is 220,000 miles, which is on the moon structure, is like, if I remember this correctly, about 65% less expensive to be on the moon. Another factor is health. It is much healthier for the human being be under the gravitation pool than without it. I'm not going to hold it longer because you promise people to be on a certain subject. I just wanted them to refresh a little bit before you go to the next route. Back to you, Antarctica.
Okay, there are people who think that a human being is healthier in a low gravity environment. That's controversial because everybody in a low gravity environment starts suffering bone loss. And even if you do a whole lot of exercise, you can't completely counter that one. It is my belief that mankind was designed for 1G of gravity and 1 atmosphere of pressure. And you put him in under any other condition, higher or lower atmosphere, higher or lower gravity, in general, he's not as healthy. That's a belief on my part. Yes, the Orion and constellation is being built to replace the space shuttle. Let me drop. For supplying equipment to the International Space Station. And in theory, it has the capability of further manned missions in space, including the moon, in theory. But the total cost of getting a man back on the moon is so high compared to an unmanned mission. And you said that you think it's going to take place in 6 years. That would be the year 2016, roughly. 2017 is the year that Medicare is predicted to go broke. If you start launching another $33 billion program in 1969 dollars, which will be $66 billion in 2016 dollars, you try to launch a $66 billion program. At the same time, Medicare is going broke, and you've got a lot of senior citizens in this nation that will be hollering, what am I getting for my money? Why aren't you doing it with an unmanned mission? What's the advantage of sending a man? They're going to ask those questions. Because of the answers they're going to get to those questions, it is my belief that it's not going to happen in 16 years. But we'll see. You've made a prediction. I'm putting it on my calendar, Wesley. I'm putting it on my tickler file. Let me drop. On the year 2016, I'm going to call you up, and I'm going to say, Wesley, how many men do we have on the moon? If I'm alive on 2016, I'm going to make that phone call to a man in Queens. I'm going to ask that question. I'm having a little fun with you. So I'm expressing opinions, you're expressing opinions. We'll find out. Fascinating subject. But let's getting back to balance now. We've only scratched the surface of balance. Balance work with transmission lines. Balance work with antennas. There are current balance, there are voltage balance, there are impedance matching balance. There's 20 different kinds of balance. If you go to the Ruff article, you just Google the word Ruff, R-U-T-H-R-O-F-F, and Microwave Theory and Technique Society, roughly 1968. Beautiful article. And much of that article is now in the balance section of the fourth edition of the Antenna Engineering Handbook by Volakis. Lots and lots of balance. Lots of theory, some beautiful pictures of them. And there are more kinds of balance than there are transmission lines. And boy, there's a lot of kinds of transmission lines. Twin lead, coax, fin line, strip line, microstrip, coplanar waveguide with ground plane. I think I said fin line. Non-symmetric lines. There's lots and lots of kinds of transmission lines. Trough line, waveguide, round waveguide, elliptical waveguide, square waveguide, rectangular waveguide, tall waveguide, tall guide it's called, very low loss, and so on. There's lots and lots of kinds of transmission lines. There's lots and lots of kinds of balance. And many of the things you've heard about balance are nowhere near as severe as you think. So to get a perfect impedance match on the input end and the output end of a balance that has enough dynamic range to it, let me drop.
W.
That is not an absolute requirement. Okay, I guess you wanted to make a comment, Paul. Go ahead, Paul, because I made some comments about space. You're the spaceman. Tell me, am I being overly pessimistic? WS2N, K2RIW.
No, I was going to go with the balance topic, Dick. I'm going with 2020. That's my... You can call me up then. I'll tell you there's four on the moon. That's my guess, Dick. I don't know. If they cut the budget, there's not going to be anybody up there. But yeah, you're right. The cheap way to go is the lunar missions. Look, we've done two, and how many people even realize that the La Crosse mission and the crash into the moon on purpose recently, and very inexpensive. In fact, that piggybacked a ride on the other spacecraft, the Mars reconnaissance, the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, that's LRO, that's now in orbit, that took pictures of all the spacecraft that crashed into the moon. In fact, it took beautiful pictures of all the landing sites, the landing pads, the parts that were left from the all the limbs, the six of them that are sitting on the moon, Dick. So. Now, I wanted to comment about the W2AU balance. One of the Mel's ever put an ohmmeter across that one. What I didn't like is they have it shorted. My question is, I wonder why they have that shorted. Wonder if all the balance like that. That I didn't like because I like to put it on me to, in the shack and see what I get. And very unnerving to see the thing shorted, or, you know, 100% shorted out. Back to you, Dick.
Now, I'm a little bit confused by that one, Paul. The W2AU type ballon, to my knowledge, the way it's constructed is that you've got a coax connector at the bottom. There is a piece of coax cable flowing through the center of it. The center conductor goes to one of the dipole eyes. The shield of the internal coax cable goes to the other eye. And the two eyes on the outside top of the ballon are where the dipole gets connected. And in between is a whole bunch of these ferrite toroids stacked along the outside of the coax cable, acting as an RF choke. Therefore, when I measure from the shield of the input coax connector to one of the output eyes, I will measure 0 ohms. To the other output eye, I should measure infinity. And when I go to the center conductor of the connector at the bottom, I should get the opposite result. So there should be a direct feed-through, but I'm having trouble believing that there is a short circuit on the input end when the output end is properly used. Maybe on some of those ballons they put a RF choke across the output, but I'm a little bit doubtful about that one. Are you sure that you've seen with the ballon? Let me drop. If I had the bare ballon sitting on the table with nothing connected to it, and I put an ohmmeter on the input coaxial cable between center conductor and shield, are you sure in that condition, with the bare ballon sitting on the bench, I would see a short circuit? WS2N, K2LIW. And by the way, after you answer, I'm going to ask Mel the exact same question. Over to you first, Paul.
Yeah, that's what I remember. I bought one of these things, really nothing but PVC pipe, two caps, and like you said, a couple of eyes. But on the inside, you know, they have a coil, and then they had some kind of, I don't know what you want to call it, shunting wire or whatever it was, going from one to the other. So, I don't know if they were trying to, I don't know what they were trying to do, but they, yeah, if you take an ohmmeter and you went to the center connection, and you went to the shield, it was shorted out. I mean, I heard it's true that you could take let's say, a dipole. I've heard you say this before, where you could take the two connections and just hook up this long wire, and the wire could be connected, and it would work fine. And for some reason, they were doing that, which was kind of unnerving. I bought this thing. I homebrewed a 2 meter. I'm sorry, a two element 10 meter beam, and I used that for many years. And when I took it down, I got a little rough with it. It cracked, you know. So that was the end of that. I took it apart to see how this thing worked, and that's what I found there. Some kind of a shorting wire between the two. Back to net, WS2N.
Okay, you said something that's kind of magic. There are a zillion kinds of ballon, and some of the ballons have turns of wire in a bipolar or a trifolar manner wrapped around a toroid core. That's different than the kind of ballon I'm talking about. The W2AU ballon is a old 1.5 inch or so diameter piece of PVC pipe, about 10 inches long, with a UHF connector at the bottom end, usually, and those two eyes at the top, and maybe another support, a ring at the very top. And those, I don't think, are a short circuit, but I'll bet you Mel's worked more with these ballons than I have. Let's see what he's got to say about all this. K2KEY, should they be a short circuit, Mel? K2RIW?
Exactly, this is K2KEY. Okay, let me continue now. Yes, I will answer Paul's question with a yes. There will be a short circuit. That ballon is based on a design by Grinnella, G-U-A-N-E-L-L-A, Grinnella ballon. It's marketed on the W2AU. The one that Dick is talking about, the one that's on a piece of feed line with the beads, that is a different situation. Completely, it is not in that little cylinder. In the cylinder, they had two versions. The original version had a ferrite rod, just a straight piece of rod, and then what they call a tri-filer winding, three-wire winding. They later on came out with the same situation using a toroidal type of device. That's the answer to that. Do you want me to say more about that, or can I go on with a very important question? Over.
Yeah, I have seen, when I got all of the books and whatever from Mr. Civic, W2FMI, and I'm very glad, very unhappy that he's now a silent key. When I got his books and I read about the Grinnella, I can see how it is a DC short circuit, even though RF-wise it is not. So it looks like a Grinnella-type Allen must be measured with some kind of an impedance bridge or a bird wattmeter with the right kind of a dummy load resistor at the far end. Yeah, they are a DC short circuit, and so, yes, with your own meter, it's a bit unnerving. Back to you, Mel, K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, very easy to measure it with, if you have one of these handheld antenna analyzers. You can terminate it, like, with a 50-ohm resistor, and then you should measure 200, you should be able to see the SWR is 4 to 1, and so on and so forth. So, you can test the Balaam that way on the bench, no big deal. Now, let me talk about this question that I've gotten, a number of them. I have a kilowatt tuner, and the Balaam has failed a number of times. The balance feed into that Balaam in the tuner has busted, cracked, smoked. I've heard this a number of times. Why? It's a kilowatt rating. Now, let me say this. This is especially been a problem with using these tuners on 160 and 80 meters. And I'll tell you what happens, because I've explained this to a number of people on 75 meters, and I know they think I'm nuts, but I'm going to say it again. If you have, for instance, let's say we were sticking with this 9-to-1 Balaam that we were talking about a little earlier. Forget about the 4-to-1. Let's talk about the 9-to-1. It's easier to understand. There is a 9-to-1 Balaam that is available. As I say, Amazon Kits puts out all kinds of Balaams, as Dick also alluded to. Let's say we have this 450-ohm feed line like we were talking before, the ladder line. And we were able to, you'd think a 9-to-1 Balaam would do the job. However, at a half wave long, the antenna now that you're using on 160 meters, when you go to 80 meters and it becomes a quarter wave long, you can have resistances, which I've seen in the book, somewhere over 4,000 ohms. So a broadband Balaam, which they really designed it for, cannot be designated to handle impedances in the 4,000 ohms. It's very likely that a well-designed 50 to a 450 ohm Balaam would experience, particularly when you do this 160 to 80 meters, the harmful flux that will build up in the balance, excessive heating, especially large voltage drops that will be present, will destroy the balance. That's it. And this is what is happening, why these balance are being destroyed. In fact, that's why I don't use a balance in my system, Dick, over.
There are kinds of balance you could use, like the so-called half-wave coax balance. Up to the point where you arc over the coax, it has no saturation characteristics. But if your balance contains any kinds of iron, I don't care if it's ferrite, laminated thin core sheets of steel or iron or whatever, if it's got any kind of iron, it is subject to saturation. Very similar to what happens if I take a 60 cycle transformer designed for 120 volts input in the United States, and if I went over to United Kingdom where they run on 50 hertz instead of 60, and assuming I had 120 happen to run on 240 over there. If I had 120 volts available to me in the United Kingdom, and I put it into